On this episode of Most Notorious, an 1897 expedition to find the South Pole leads to death, despair, and incredible heroism.
They tried to throw him a line, but eventually they looked to the side of the ship and they saw that he was lying on his back and foaming at the mouth, and his face was dark and he had died. And this was before they'd even made landfall in Antarctica. And it cast a pall on the rest of the expedition.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Most Notorious podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Great to have you here with me. If you really love the Most Notorious podcast, please consider heading over to patreon.com/mostnotorious. That's patreon.com/mostnotorious. Thank you in advance. So, it is so great to have as my guest today, Julian Sangton. He has been a senior features editor at Departures magazine, where he wrote about travel and culture. His work has appeared in major magazines like Vanity Fair, Esquire, and The New Yorker. And he is here to talk about his brand new book called Madhouse at the End of the Earth, The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Yes. So where did you first get the idea to write a book about this ill-fated expedition to the Antarctic?
Well, it was about 2015, and I was sitting at my desk at Departures, killing time by reading a copy of The New Yorker. And I was flipping through, and I found this article that seemed really interesting about how NASA is planning missions to Mars by, among other things, having these sort of simulations in suitably Martian type environments on Earth, like the surface of a Hawaiian volcano. But the very beginning of this story was unexpected. It was a 3 or 4 paragraph summary of a polar expedition from 120 years ago that went horribly awry. The ship left from Belgium. It was a scientific expedition and was stuck in the ice, where they became the first men to endure the cruelties of an Antarctic winter. And I found this just irresistible. These men were ravaged by scurvy, and some went insane. And to me, this idea of insanity in the poles was like something out of Edgar Allan Poe, or Coleridge, or the H.P. Lovecraft. And when I kept reading, and it mentioned that the physician on board was a man named Frederick Cook. He was an American, and he came up with these ingenious interventions that saved most of, but certainly not all of, his shipmates' lives, and help extricate the ship from the ice in a great escape plan. And also on board was a man who, even if you know very little about Antarctic exploration, you probably would have heard his name, Roald Amundsen, the great Norwegian explorer who would go on to discover the South Pole, or to reach the South Pole. And he was an apprentice on this ship. So all these elements, the fact that there's this heroic anti-hero in Frederick Cook, I should say that Frederick Cook is remembered today, if he's remembered at all, as the man who lied about attaining the North Pole first. So there's the guy who lied about the North Pole. There's the guy who actually reached the South Pole. There's insanity at the poles. There's a ship caught in ice, the first winter spent in the Antarctic. It was just too good to be true. It felt so cinematic. So I called my friend, who fittingly enough is a screenwriter, and I told him, you've got to write this as your next screenplay. And he says, you know what, in Hollywood, nobody does anything original anymore. It's got to be based on something, some IP, you know? So maybe if there were a book. And so based on that, I checked, has there been a book written for the general public on this? And sure enough, there hadn't been. I thought maybe that's because there hasn't been enough, the men didn't come back with enough primary sources to base a book on. And the more I looked, the more untrue that became. In fact, it was one of the most well-documented expeditions of that of the era. And so it was a historian's dream to have just such a great story and so much material to tell it with.
Yeah, yeah, it really is a wild story. It's almost hard to believe at points. So this expedition was initially a pretty fanciful idea. It was the brainchild of a young man who was the citizen of a country that had very little in the way of nautical history, right?
Yeah, yeah. His name was Adrien de Gerlache. He was a Belgian aristocrat, and in his mid-20s, he grew up in love with the sea, which, as you mentioned, is an unusual fixation for a young man growing up in Belgium, because the country had only 40 miles of coastline and no maritime tradition to speak of. Once they'd separated from the Netherlands in 1830, Holland basically assumed all of the maritime roles that had and left Belgium with very little in that respect. And so they didn't have a navy. They had a bare bones merchant marine. And so nevertheless, Adrien de Gerlache grew up making model ships and dreaming of the sea and reading tales of seafaring adventure and exploration. And at this point, he had served on many foreign ships as a deckhand and rose through the very meager ranks of the Belgium maritime establishment, to the extent that there was any. And he wants to set out on his own. He wants to lead his own adventure somewhere. And at that time, the geographical societies of the Western world had met and agreed that if there was one region on Earth that needed to be explored most urgently, that was Antarctica. And so he decided, as all the other kind of great seafaring nations are trying to come up with the funding for an elaborate, ambitious expedition, he thinks, well, why couldn't it be me? Why not Belgium? Why not me? And turns out there were many reasons why Belgium was maybe not the best place to kick off an Antarctic expedition from. But he didn't let that stop him. He didn't let the difficulties in raising money stop him, nor the difficulties in finding qualified Belgian sailors stop him, because he found a certain number and had to fill out the ranks with Norwegian sailors who had much more experience with the ice. He didn't let the fact that Belgian scientists were skeptical of the expedition, and though a few expressed interest at first, by the time it actually left, they figured, no, I don't trust that this is going to be well run or well funded. And so he had to find Eastern European scientists, and then couldn't find a Belgian doctor, so he had to find an American doctor. So by default, it became an international expedition, and that was a pretty remarkable achievement at that time in history, which was jingoistic and imperialistic. It was sort of a jingoistic frenzy that would lead to war within 20 years. And yet, here he is launching an international expedition and planning to fly the flag of many nations over the Antarctic pack, over the next frontier of human exploration. And I think that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it sure is. So as you've established, the Belgians didn't have a long maritime history, nor shipbuilders who could build a vessel that could withstand the harsh Antarctic weather. Where did he finally find an expedition-worthy ship?
Well, he figured smartly that he had had a lot of experience on board transatlantic ocean liners and a few harrowing experiences in ships that rounded the Cape Horn. So he was well experienced. But he did not have any experience of the ice, and that's a completely different kind of navigation. And so before setting out to Antarctica, he realized he needed to prepare himself. So he arranged with a ship owner who had a fleet of whalers in Scandinavia to tag along for one hunting season. They were hunting whales and seals in the Arctic Circle or beyond the Arctic Circle. And it would double as also a scouting mission where he would try to see if there was a ship that was available for sale and that he could use to take to the other side of the world in Antarctica, where the conditions were similar. And the ship would also have to confront massive fields of ice. And it was during that trip that he first laid eyes on the Belgica. and it was the small, scrappy little ship, but he was really impressed with her nimbleness and the way she negotiated the ice. And she could, she was even designed to be an ice breaker. She would, was, you know, fast enough and light enough to climb on top of floes and then with her weight fall back down on them and split them, which is how ice breaking worked then and to an extent still now. And she was not for sale, but eventually through some savvy negotiation through a Norwegian intermediary, he was able to get her and he refit the ship. He converted it to prepare her for an Antarctic winter and a few other things. But in any case, it was a converted Norwegian whale ship that ended up taking Dojralaš and his men to Antarctica.
He felt a lot of pressure, right, from his funders, the government.
Oh, yeah.
To make this a Belgian-centric expedition. And he was forced to take on an international crew. This had to have been frustrating for him.
Well, yeah, again, as I mentioned, it was a period of, you know, nationalism and jingoism. And he had sold this, the way he was able to get interest in this expedition, the way he was able to raise funds is by selling it as a national expedition that would fly the Belgian flag to the ends of the earth, which, you know, Belgium was still a young nation, and it was great PR for the country. And he also raised funds by organizing a national subscription, meaning people sent money, everybody from a mailman to a senator to a school teacher could send money to contribute to this expedition. So he felt beholden to all of them. He was representing his country as the commander of this expedition. He also had an illustrious, you know, he was a member of an illustrious family. His father and grandfather were both decorated military officers. He, a great uncle, had been the first prime minister of Belgium. And so he was also representing his family. And so the thing that he feared possibly even more than the Antarctic and the cruelties that it could visit on the human body and soul was the humiliation that he was risking by sailing down there. He feared failure, not because he feared death, but because he feared humiliation.
So what were the goals of the expedition? What was the planned route? How long did they think they would be gone?
He planned to have it be a two-year expedition. And the first year, he planned on getting to the Antarctic Peninsula, and which is the sort of finger-like appendage that you see, almost like that points towards the tip of South America. And he hoped to explore that from a scientific perspective. This was going to be the first scientific expedition to Antarctica. And so he hoped to spend a good amount of time there with the scientists, cataloging the flora and fauna, the meteorology, the ocean temperatures, ocean depths, geology, figure out what this, what the Antarctic Andes, the great mountain chain of the Antarctic Peninsula, whether that was predominantly granite or basalt or what have you. So it was a really thorough scientific expedition. But then he also had an almost conflicting goal, which was to reach the South Magnetic Pole. It was an exploit that would have electrified the public, and so here, this is the conflict that ended up plaguing, you know, dooming the Belgica. Because if you want to do thorough scientific research, you want to take your time. You want to move slowly. You want to move deliberately and catalog things exhaustively. Otherwise, you're not doing serious scientific work. On the other hand, if you want to reach a high southern latitude in a short amount of time, you have to move very fast. And so he was not able to square that circle. And by the time he and his shipmates and the scientists were done exploring the Antarctic Peninsula, it was already getting very late and the winter sea ice was setting in. And so he tried to circumnavigate the continent as fast as possible to get to the other side of the South Magnetic Pole was assumed to be south of Australia, so on the other side of the world. But the skirt of sea ice was around the continent was growing. And that project seemed doomed. At that point, he had almost no money left, and he feared that he was going to have to go back to Belgium with nothing to show for the first year of the expedition. And in late February, a terrible storm shattered the pack, the pack ice of the Bellingshausen Sea, and opened up a tantalizing lead of ice, an avenue to the south. And de Gerlache had a moment of truth. He thought, do I go back with my head low and attempt to get more money for a second year of the expedition, or do I risk it all and try to go south and see what happens? And he chose the latter option and ended up dooming the 19 men of the Belgica to, or at that point there were 18 men, they'd already lost a man, to suffer the first winter, Antarctic winter ever experienced by human beings.
So I'd love it if you could talk about Roald Amundsen.
Yeah.
Where he fits into all of this.
Yeah, he was 26 years old at the time. As I've mentioned, he would go on to be an almost mythical Viking-like hero in the field of polar exploration. He would blaze through the Northwest Passage. He would be the first to attain the South Pole. And the funny thing is, he, almost from the get-go, from the moment he was a teenager, he imagined this destiny for himself and worked deliberately to achieve it. So for him, the Belgica was a kind of a training ground, an education. He's 6'2", almost 200 pounds of pure muscle. He was just, he was a figure out of myth. And while everybody else was suffering from the lack of light, from depression, from despair, from scurvy, from a mysterious polar malaise that seems to affect overwintering crews, from the lack of women, Amundsen, even though he was showing physical symptoms, did not consider it suffering. He saw it as growth. He saw it as a step in the right direction. And so he ended up thriving. And it ended up making him, or turning him into the explorer that he became.
So almost right off the bat, there were issues, conflict between Belgian and Norwegian crew members. And the hierarchy was a little bit muddled, too.
Yeah, indeed. The Belgians on board were probably, they were rowdier, less disciplined, and probably less qualified than the Norwegian sailors. Possibly it's because they felt that this was a Belgian mission, and so they felt that they had priority over the Norwegians. And when in fact, that's not the case, right? Roald Amundsen was hired as the first mate. And so this did muddle the hierarchy, and it led to some real anger and in some cases to fisticuffs, not between the Belgians and the Norwegians, but they all took it out on the Frenchmen. The Belgians beat the tar out of the French cook, and tempers boiled, and eventually this all led to a near mutiny in Punta Arenas, where de Gerlache was confronted by a gun-toting Belgian sailor, and eventually it was by a miracle the mutiny didn't go through. But indeed, I think that as inspiring as the international makeup of this expedition was, it was also a liability, and it became deadly at one point because during a biblical storm in the Drake Passage, or I believe in the Bransfield Strait, right before getting to Antarctica, there was the Belgica was tossed like it had never been before on raging seas, and at one point a man fell overboard, a Norwegian man fell overboard, but his shipmate who witnessed this accident ran to the helmsman, who was Belgian, and told him to turn the ship around. He wanted him to hove to, and he just didn't understand. So they tried to explain it through sign language, and eventually I argue that this language barrier was, in that case, fatal.
And we will be back after a brief break. We have returned. I find it so interesting. I mean, I can understand Belgium at the time not being able to find qualified crewmen or even scientists, but a doctor.
Yeah.
His struggle to find a doctor.
Yeah.
Would you talk about that? How Dr. Cook came to join?
It seemed to be almost a cursed position. At first, there was a notable Belgian doctor who had signed on to this expedition, and it was believed that he was almost a Trojan horse for the Royal Belgian Geographical Society, that he was a spy for them, and that he would end up trying to take command of the expedition away from de Gerlache. And so de Gerlache didn't want, you know, any of that competition on board. And eventually he shied away from confrontation. So he had his father do the dirty work and smear him in the press and get him off of the ship. But then de Gerlache was not able to find a replacement, or rather he found several replacement, all of which begged off at the last minute. And he couldn't find anybody else. And so then the choice was either to go to Antarctica without a physician on board, or to hire a foreign doctor. And as it happened, he had an application that he had considered and dismissed before, a telegram from a certain Dr. Frederick Cook, a larger-than-life, already notorious explorer slash showman who lived in Brooklyn and had applied for the position. And he said, well, it's either go with no doctor at all or go with Frederick Cook. And he did. And that ended up being the best decision that de Gerlache ever made.
Yeah, Cook is such a complicated character. On the one hand, he's so competent. He's imaginative. He's incredibly smart. But he's almost too smart for his own good.
Yeah, he is. He's, I'll give you a few examples of what he did. When the ship was ravaged with scurvy, he wondered what could be causing it. And we at that point, scurvy had already been supposedly cured. It had, in the 19th century, Lind had, for the Royal Navy, had conducted the first clinical trials ever and determined that scurvy could be cured with lemon juice, for example. And they also knew that sauerkraut and certain other foods could do it. And as the 19th century, it became common practice to take lemon juice on long ocean trips. But by the 19th century, when the steam engine had shortened the average length of a voyage, the British felt comfortable in replacing expensive lemons with cheap limes. And everybody, de Gerlache had emulated the British strategy of bringing lime juice along and thinking that that would be enough to keep scurvy at bay. That wasn't at all the case. In fact, bottled lime juice, in the bottling process, the vitamin C is destroyed. It's a very, very delicate compound. So Cook was wondering what can be done. And he had lived in, or he had lived, he had explored the north of Greenland and had lived among the Inuit for a while, and noticed that even though they have no fresh fruit, they also didn't suffer from scurvy. And so he assumed that there was something in the Inuit diet of fresh meat that kept scurvy at bay. In retrospect, you would say pretty obvious, but aboard the Belgica, it was the proposal was resisted. He said that the expeditioners should eat almost exclusively raw or very rare penguin and seal, and that would cure the scurvy. And he was absolutely right. And so that was something that his medical education did not spell out. That's not something that it did not prepare him for. Yet he always believed that the wisdom of the Inuit in polar matters was to be trusted much more than modern science. And in that respect, he was right. And another example of Cook's ingenuity is when, after months of darkness, he saw his shipmates atrophy, both mentally and physically. He assumed that there was something about sunlight that was essential to human well-being, and that sunlight was as crucial to humans as it was to plants, for example. And so, since he couldn't bring the Belgica to the sun because it was stuck fast in the ice, he wondered if he could bring light to the Belgica. And so he had his shipmates stand naked for hours on end in front of a glowing fire, and thereby invented the idea of light therapy, which is used routinely today to treat seasonal affective disorder and other kinds of depression. So he became a sun worshiper. And even though that idea was a pretty genius one and led to modern phototherapy, here's an example of how Cook's imagination somehow led him astray. He was so enamored with the sun and in awe of its power that he thought that ice itself could store light. He thought that after a sunny day, the ice glowed brighter than it did after a cloudy day. He conducted all sorts of experiments that he claimed proved this, which is in fact a complete nonsense. But he was at once a scientist and almost a religious nut, the deity he believed in was the sun.
One of the more interesting friendships that is developed is between Cook and Amundsen.
Yeah,
Cook has a lot of experience. As you've said, in the Arctic Circle, he traveled and lived with the Inuit. He came dressed in clothes that were far more suited to cold climates than the rest of his colleagues did. He could climb mountains, icebergs, and Amundsen was in absolute awe of him.
Absolutely. This is one of the dynamics that made me want to write the book. And that I tried to make the core of the story is the friendship between Cook, who would end up becoming this notorious fraud and this punchline, and Amundsen, who ended up being hailed as a godlike polar hero. And the fact that Amundsen learned so much from Cook, and that even as Cook was maligned, even as Cook ended up in Leavenworth prison for running a Ponzi scheme, even as his accomplishments were all cast into doubt, Amundsen always believed in him and spoke for him in the press and called him the greatest traveler he ever knew. And so it's so poignant to me. It's so touching, the loyalty that Amundsen had for Cook for the rest of his life.
De Gerlache was definitely an interesting character as well. He was such a skilled sailor.
Yeah.
But as a commander, and especially a disciplinarian, he left a lot to be desired.
He did. And he was a shy boy growing up. He spent most of his time reading books and making model ships, as I mentioned. He was a brilliant man. He was an excellent writer. And this often happens in polar history where, the missions are led by people who are driven more by romance than anything else. You think of Robert Falcon Scott was a great poet as well, and a great writer. And De Gerlache, that quality doesn't make somebody a great charismatic leader. And De Gerlache indeed was unable at key moments to assert his authority. And so that led to a near mutiny. It led to a breakdown in discipline. And it led his second in command, a Belgian named Georges Lecointe, to be much stricter and take control of the ship as best he could. So it does reflect poorly on De Gerlache in that sense, but I think that his dream of getting to the Antarctic and of leading this scientific expedition and of leading an international expedition, and especially perhaps of not claiming any territory for Belgium, making it a purely scientific endeavor, I think those are all admirable decisions. And I think, as I argue at the end of the book, I believe that spirit set the stage for the Antarctic Treaty of 1959, of which Belgium was a signatory, and which guaranteed that the Antarctic would be reserved, that military activity would be banned on the Antarctic, and that the Antarctic would be reserved as an area of peaceful scientific international cooperation. And that, in turn, that geopolitical miracle, in turn, led to a similar spirit of collaboration at the International Space Station, which will presumably inspire future deep space exploration. So I think perhaps it's a bold claim, but I do believe that Adrien de Gerlache was at the is to be credited with at least in part this. One of the greatest achievements in human history, which is the fact that there is a continent on which there has never been war.
Hmm. Would you mind telling the story of how they lost their first crew member in January of 1898?
Yeah, it's a really tragic story, and I read so many accounts of this. So many of the diaries mentioned this. It was a traumatic event for a lot of them. And it still brings a ball to my throat when I read the last diary entry of the man you're talking about. His name was Carl Vinke. And he was Norwegian. He had just turned 20. He was a sailor beloved by all. He liked to take risks. He liked to climb the rigging. He liked to work unsecured, even during storms. He thrilled to the sound of storms, to the movement of the ship during storms. And he was at the helm on the night of January 22nd, when there was a terrible snowstorm and the ocean became enraged, and icebergs were to the left and right of the ship. And it was a chaotic moment. And at one point, the deck was flooded with water because they had taken on too much coal, and coal had gotten stuck in the scuppers, which are the openings at the level of the deck from which seawater can escape. If a wave crashes over the gunwales, it escapes to the scuppers. But now it couldn't escape because coal had blocked it. And so his job, Amundsen had assigned Vinke to unclog this scupper, and he wasn't able to do it by standing within the bulwark. So he tried to get at it from the outside, and a wave, as he was working, a wave washed over him, and he fell into the freezing, turgid waters of the Bransfield Strait. And the water, I assume, was probably it couldn't have been colder than 30 degrees Fahrenheit because of the salinity, but it also couldn't have been much warmer than that. And he was fast receding from the ship, and in one of the most mind-bogglingly courageous actions that anybody took during this expedition, or even in the heroic age of Antarctic exploration, LeQuint, the captain of the ship, jumped in after him and risked his own life. He had him in his arms, and LeQuint was tethered to the ship, but the rocking of the ship was such that every time the ship would rock the other direction and come back, they were hung at the end of this line as if they were hung from gallows. And eventually the weight of Vinke with his waterlogged clothes was too much for LeQuint to carry. And they tried to throw him a line, but eventually they looked to the side of the ship and they saw that he was lying on his back and foaming at the mouth, and his face was dark, and he had died. And this was before they'd even made landfall in Antarctica. And it cast a pall on the rest of the expedition.
Yeah, normally he would tie a rope around his waist, right?
Well, the Amundsen would always have to remind him to tie a rope around himself, which is a common practice on ships even today. You know, during a storm, if there's no need to be walking around unfastened, you know, if you're working on the outside of the ship, if you have to lean over the ship during a storm, you need to be fastened. And he was just a bit of a daredevil. He was washed away. He was really, because he was young and starry-eyed and had such an effusive personality, everybody really loved him. He was a great sailor, but he ended up being the first casualty of the Belgica, and they describe watching him recede from the ship and sink, and they kept looking until they could no longer see the yellow of his oilskin coat.
So this decision that de Gerlache makes to push forward as winter approaches, he basically makes it alone, right? I mean, Amundsen definitely supports him for his own personal reasons, dreams of glory. But the crew and the scientists on board especially are terrified of spending a winter in the Antarctic.
They were terrified. I wouldn't say that he made it alone. He made it, he shook on it on this decision with the captain. The two of them agreed. And so the captain had his back, LeQuint, the man who jumped in the water after Vinke. But it was definitely de Gerlache's idea, and the scientists were petrified at this prospect. Rightly so. They claimed that it was because they were worried about their scientific collections. They're specimens of penguins and seals and microbial life, or their geological samples would be threatened, and they would do no good if the ship were crushed by ice and sank to the bottom of the sea. So, but in fact, they were afraid for their own lives. And as I said, they were right to be. And that became very clear in the months that followed.
Do you think he committed a crime by forcing the ship south, knowing that there would likely be deaths?
I don't think so. Because he was not violating any contract. Death did ensue from this decision, but he justified it by arguing that during the storm that he took advantage of to make his way into the ice, it is often a good idea to not remain at the fringes of the pack ice during storms. It's, you can seek shelter temporarily within the pack where the waves are not as powerful, and you don't run the risk of having icebergs thrown onto the ship, or giant floes thrown into the ship by the storm-tossed seas. But he went way further into the pack than would be required if that were simply his motivation. So I don't think he committed a crime. That's an interesting question. I think everybody knew what they'd signed on to, that danger was part of this expedition, and he can't be directly connected to the death of his best friend, for example, for which he felt a tremendous amount of guilt. But I don't think it was criminal guilt. I think it was just a more of a moral thing.
I mean, they were all really fortunate to survive, except his friend, of course. But they were constantly averting disaster.
Yeah. You know, there's only so much they could do, really, because the ice was going to do what the ice was going to do. I try to treat the ice in my book like the antagonist, like either the white whale or the great white shark. There's something about whiteness that makes it even more terrifying, I guess, and makes it a mirror for all of our own fears. But yes, the many times the ice started crushing the ship and let up at the last second. And you know, there were also cases where Dujarlaj, for example, fell through the ice and was only caught at the last second by Cook, who saved him from falling beneath the pack ice, which would have been a death sentence. Every step on the ice is a leap of faith. And so they had a year of not being able to trust the ground they walked on.
And there were rats that had snuck aboard as well.
Indeed, yeah. That added to the maddening nature of this trip. That the only creatures who seemed to be thriving were the rats, who had scurried along a line at the port of Punta Arenas and nested in the hold. And throughout the Antarctic night, they could be heard multiplying and squeaking and scurrying, to the point where it felt to a lot of the men that the rats were scurrying in their own heads.
Dujarlaj was one of the few on board who refused to eat fresh meat. The penguin specifically disgusted him. And the illness, the scurvy that followed for him, produced some questionable command decisions, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I asked his grandson why Dujarlaj refused to eat the penguin, even though he knew it, Cook insisted that it would cure him of scurvy. And his grandson said, well, because it was revolting. That might be part of it, but if he knew that it would save his life, surely he could have stomached it. I think he didn't fully trust Cook. He didn't believe that Cook was right about it. And he probably believed that he had spent so much of his countrymen's money in buying the best tinned food possible that he felt he owed it to them to eat that food, as opposed to abandoning it for penguin. So that could have been it. It could have been that he felt that eating penguin was somehow uncivilized. But whatever the case, he did end up suffering tremendously from his reluctance to eat it. And even when he was at death's door and forced to eat it, he could only keep it down if it were charred to within an inch of its life, which as we now know, if you overcook meat, then you also disintegrate the vitamin C that's within it. And so he ended up, yes, being very, very sick. in July and August, which would have been the winter and spring of the Southern Hemisphere, he was convinced that he was going to die, and decided that he was not going to pursue the main goal of the expedition, which was to reach the South Magnetic Pole. And through voluminous correspondence, he exchanged letters with his shipmates, which I always found to be noteworthy. That there was, even though it was a small ship, 100 feet long, they were writing letters to each other, and he wrote letters about how Cook and Amundsen and LeQuint should make their own way to the South Magnetic Pole. It perplexed everybody, and also saddened everybody to see that he had essentially given up. But he would redeem himself at the end, becoming a key part in the strategy to break out of the ice.
We will return momentarily. And we are back. What does penguin taste like?
Penguin, I tried to find a way to eat penguin, and unfortunately for me, but fortunately for penguins, they're protected by the 1991 Madrid Protocol. So it's described in multiple ways by the men of the Belgica, and all of them are each one is more unappetizing than the next. I think Cook describes it as, let me see if I can find it here. Okay, here we got it. Okay. Cook describes it as so, quote, "If it is possible to imagine a piece of beef, an odoriferous codfish, and a canvas-back duck roasted in a pot with blood and cod liver oil for sauce, the illustration will be complete." So that was pretty poetic and revolting. There's also other, you can draw from the descriptions of other explorers who have eaten it. So James Clark Ross, the great British explorer of the mid-19th century, says the flesh is very dark and of a rank fishy flavor. And then meanwhile, the only person who seemed to like it at first was Roald Amundsen, who described it as the best steaks you could hope for. Again, because he was almost masochistic in his pursuit of glory. He equated suffering with accomplishment. And so I think that might explain it. It also might have pleased his Scandinavian palate. But in the end, because it had so many benefits to their health, the men ended up craving penguin. And as Cook and de Gerlache led the men in a plan to saw their way out of a mile's worth of ice, to saw a canal for the ship to escape the pack ice, it was such a tremendous amount of work. It was a feat of glacial engineering, and required nonstop sawing from the men. And so these men, who were completely broken down by the winter, built their bodies back, built their hope back, and ate 6, 7, 8 penguin steaks a day. And they became, Cook says they started growing ponderous muscles. And it was just after this year of wallowing in depression and sickness, all of a sudden, with hope comes a rebuilding of the human body. It's a really inspiring moment.
So yeah, they mostly survived the polar night, the Antarctic winter, basically hoping that once the summer hit, the sun would melt the ice and they would be able to break out. But that wasn't happening, and another winter was looming, forcing them to take drastic action.
Yeah, absolutely. Cook knew very well that his shipmates would not survive a second winter. And de Gerlache had no expectations that he would survive one either, but he also didn't think that there was anything he could do. And Cook, this eternal optimist, this almost delusional optimist, said that, well, we need to try. And that's a very American instinct of his, I think. And it reminds me of McMurphy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, when he grabs the sink and he says he bets all the men that he can pull the sink off of the floor and throw it into the window and escape. And he says, "Well, damn it, I tried." You know. So I think Cook had that same instinct. And he amid his own cuckoo's nest, and he tried a plan to because, as I mentioned, he was a sun worshiper, he thought that he would allow the sun to reach the bottom layers of the ice by digging a trench and filling it with soot so that it would be blacker and draw more sunlight. And he expected that it would weaken along those lines, that the heat of the sun would weaken the ice along those lines. But the physics of that plan were ill-conceived. It just was never going to work, for reasons that I get to in the book. But Dujarlash, who at first thought it ludicrous, the idea that there could be any way that the men could have a say in their own fate, he did a complete about face, and he says, well, maybe that didn't work, but we can try something else. And so he proposed something even more ambitious, to saw through, as I mentioned, a mile's worth of ice. And they had three old ice saws there, two of which they combined so that one saw was 6 feet long, which was necessary because the ice in many spots was that deep, that thick. And working 24 hours a day, they sawed and as the ice closed back up, they kept on reopening their canal, and it was a constant fight against the ice to keep this open. And even just as they thought that they were going to break out, the ice closes back up again. The jaws that I described closed back up, and they started again. It's the climax of the book, so I think I don't want to describe too much, but
That's fine.
Yeah. All I want to say is that it was an epic battle between man and nature. And for me, it was, you know, reading about it in the diaries, it was akin to anything, you know, the greatest adventure novels that I've ever read.
Yeah, and Dujarlash, just when you think he's lost, he comes charging back.
Yeah. You know what this reminds me of? Not to compare it to another movie, but actually to compare it to another movie. It reminds me of Han Solo at the end of Star Wars, where he gives, you know, you think that he gives up, that he's going to let the rebellion have, he's going to abandon the rebellion, let Luke do whatever he wants to do. And then at the very end, one of the greatest moments in film history for me is when out of nowhere he comes and shoots Darth Vader. And I hope I'm not spoiling Star Wars for, you know, three people out there. But that I remember as a child, that just gave me chills, that moment where the anti-hero does the right thing and does a complete about face. And so I felt that when I read about what Dujarlash did and how he took control of the ship in a way that he had never done before and became the leader that he hadn't been until then. So yeah, that was a great moment for me.
You know, I think in 200 episodes, this is the first reference to Star Wars we've ever had on the show.
You're welcome. How many McMurphy references have you had?
That's a first too. So there is a criminal element to the story as well.
In the
guise of Dr. Cook. Would you talk about what he did once he came back to America?
Yeah. He carried out a number of expeditions afterwards, notably the first summiting of Mount Denali. He was credited as the first man to get to the summit of Denali, which was then called Mount McKinley. And he wrote a book about it, which sold very well. He wrote his next achievement, he set out to reach the North Pole. And it was announced in 1909 that September of 1909 that he had gotten there. The New York Herald published his exclusive account of the trip, and he was feted around the world. There was parades in Brooklyn, in his native Brooklyn, in Manhattan. People were serving the Cook cocktail. In Chicago, people were selling the Cook hat, which was a big rounded white dome for women, and he was celebrated worldwide. Very shortly after, his arch rival, Robert Peary, or rather allies of his arch rival, demonstrated that it was extremely unlikely that Cook had actually gotten there, and Cook was unable to provide definitive evidence of it. And so, while I wouldn't say that's a crime, it definitely pegged him as a fraud, which was an encapsulation that he would end up confirming when 3 years later, or sorry, 10 years later, he tried to remake his life as an oil man during the Texas oil boom. And he ended up using his fame, or rather his infamy, as a way to drum up interest in a number of defunct oil concerns. And it's a bit like the mortgage crisis, where, you know, the idea is if you get a bunch of bad assets together, maybe somehow something good will come of that. And that's what he did. He sold stock in these it was called the Petroleum Producers Association, and in the marketing materials that he wrote were he would talk about his experiences as a polar explorer that somehow qualified him as a geologist, and he knew that these would produce some oil and that they would strike a gusher soon, and he promised Rockefeller level wealth, and got a lot of people to sign on to this, and in order to pay dividends to the stock that he was selling, because he hadn't actually struck oil yet, he sold dividends from the sale of more stock. So your listeners may at this point be telling themselves that sounds exactly like a Ponzi scheme. And yes, it was. So he was sentenced to 14 years in Leavenworth, both for running a Ponzi scheme, but also for these deceptive marketing materials. And that was a pretty harsh sentence compared to, because several other people were doing this kind of thing at that time. There was in the wildcatting era. And I think it was in proportion to his fame, and almost as much about the oil as it was about the deception regarding the North Pole. But in jail, once he was imprisoned, he showed his beneficial side and his genius, and his fellow inmates were suffering. Also, he noticed from scurvy, much as his shipmates had in Antarctica. They were also psychologically destabilized, as they had been in Antarctica. And he ended up having the same magnetic effect, the same soothing effect in jail, in prison, as he did in Antarctica. And as in Antarctica, where he was the most popular man aboard, he was the most popular man in Leavenworth.
We have talked about Leavenworth Prison in the 1920s on this podcast before. I think Carl Panzram comes a little later, doesn't he?
No, he was a contemporary.
Oh, a contemporary. Okay.
Yeah. I think they didn't overlap the entire time, but he was a contemporary. I don't know that there's no record of them having interacted, but they were there at the same time. And Carl Panzram, as I'm sure your listeners know, was just one of the most wicked serial killers the country ever birthed. But his Cook's friend and protector there was a bootlegger named Tim Murphy, big Chicago bootlegger, who showed Cook the ropes and ended up being his, as I say, his protector.
This North Pole expedition that he mounted, it was pretty suspicious all the way around. He didn't even tell anyone that he was doing it.
Oh, yeah. Well, secrecy surrounds these things, surrounds polar exploration. And because of that, it also means that lies also are rampant. Because, you know, if you start telling people you're going to vie for the North Pole, a bunch of other people are going to try to beat you to it. But because typically you're the only one there, or you're surrounded by... You're aided by people who don't necessarily have great navigational skills or know how to use a sextant. There's also no way it's ultimately unverifiable or rather it's difficult to verify, which means it's easy to lie about. So I think that Cook got somewhat close, and here I'm depending on the research done by a historian named Robert M. Bryce, who wrote a book called Cook and Peary, the Polar Controversy Resolved. And he examines the record. He looks at some of Cook's photos and Cook's notebooks, and determines that Cook didn't get much closer than 400 miles to the pole. There are still some Cook truthers out there, as there are in many other walks of American life. There are people who will believe despite the evidence. And it's not we can't say for sure that he didn't get there, but it's very likely that he didn't.
But there are also people out there who question Robert Perry's claim, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. The National Geographic Society backed his claim in the shortly after it was made in the in 1909 that Robert Peary, who was as Cook's arch rival, who also claimed to have gotten to the pole shortly after him. Then in the 1980s, the National Geographic Society looked at newly declassified documents, or newly released archives, rather, and determined that Peary almost certainly falsified his attainment of the pole as well. And the interesting thing about that is that if neither Cook nor Peary got to the pole as they claimed they had, then the first man to get to the North Pole was one Roald Amundsen.
He got there on a dirigible.
Absolutely. So he didn't sledge there as he had to the South Pole, but nevertheless, the first verified attainment, he didn't set foot there, but he did drop a Norwegian flag on the North Pole. So the first verified attainment of the pole is Amundsen. There's also a claim by Admiral Byrd, who 2 days before Amundsen's dirigible got there, claimed to have flown over the pole. But once again, there are doubts about that.
And it was proven pretty thoroughly, right, that he lied about being the first to climb Denali.
Oh, Denali, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for reminding me. Once people had sort of cast a doubt on Cook's North Pole achievement, then Peary and his allies looked back through some of his other achievements and found that the mountaineer with whom Cook climbed Denali, that mountaineer claimed that they didn't get anywhere close to the summit, and that the photo that appeared to be a photo of the summit was a much lower part of the mountain and known as a false peak. And so that was another classic Cook deception.
So did he survive prison?
He did. He was nearly blind in one eye. He had lost his voluminous hair. He was a broken man and never really found gainful employment again. But he had a number of loyal friends, including Roald Amundsen. But Roald Amundsen had died when he was in prison, so no, he couldn't depend on Amundsen's friendship after leaving jail. But he did. It was a sad last 10 years of his life. But on his deathbed, he received word that Franklin Roosevelt pardoned him for the crime for which he was sentenced to Leavenworth. And so his some of the last recorded words of Frederick Cook are "thank you," after he heard that.
Amundsen visited him in prison and was one of the few that really stuck by him.
Yeah, right? That's what I begin and end the book with. It's just such a touching moment when the great hero and the great anti-hero meet, and Amundsen was the only person to visit Cook in prison, the only person that Cook allowed to visit him in prison. And Amundsen, who was then preparing for another expedition and doing a big promotional tour for it, and had stopped by the American Midwest, decided to pay tribute to his former mentor.
Wow. So your book just came out recently.
Yeah, it came out on Tuesday the 4th. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's my first book. Hopefully the movie that I wanted my friend to make out of it will, hopefully now at least he's got no excuse. There's a book.
And people can reach you, I believe, on Twitter, right?
Yep. I'm at Jay Sancton. So JSANCTON. And that's also my Instagram handle. And I'm not on TikTok.
Well, thank you for your time. This has been so much fun.
Thanks for yours. And thanks for, letting me discuss the book. It's just a remarkable adventure, and it had been ignored by history for 120 years. So I'm glad it's getting some attention.
Again, I have been speaking to Julian Sancton. His book is called Madhouse at the End of the Earth: The Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rimenis, and have a safe tomorrow.